Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Katrina Parmeter. Katrina's an artist who lives in the same village as me, primarily a photographer with a specialism in portraiture for weddings and brand photography and family shots. As you'll hear from our conversation, she's worked hard to make sure that her work is satisfying to her creatively, whatever the medium. And I admire the way that as an artist, she's made space for her work around her family life and embraces the fact that her practice will change over time. She was also gracious enough to let me record with her at her home. So this is the first on-location episode. There's more of that in our future, but in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Katrina. Do you find when you're kind of running around doing family stuff, because you do a lot of family portraits and kind of weddings and things like, which I admire immensely, by the way, weddings. I'm photographing a friend. Friend asked me to photograph their wedding later this year.
Yeah.
I've only done one once before for a family member. And this is like two people. The whole wedding party is like less than 10. So this feels very comfortable for for a tourist. Yeah. But that's like a sort of a big gig. Do you find that like doing all of the work that you do has changed like the way that you feel about carrying your camera around with you for like a family weekend, like an Easter weekend or something like that? Or do you still have that excitement to pick the thing up?
I go through phases. I think just like all creativity, you sometimes have rest periods and you sometimes have inspired moments. I'll be honest, the last couple of years, photography for me has, picking up my camera has been more tricky. And I've been really questioning when I'm picking up the camera and when I'm not. Something I do is create an album of images for my kids. It's like a gift to them in the future. And it comes from one of my favourite things to do at home is to, my parents have family albums, is to pick them up and just go through them. And at the moment, these images, the kids, they like them. Actually, just recently they took them out and looked through them. But the real investment and value of them will be in the years to come. So it's made me really think about what images I'm putting in there. And that makes me think about, when I'm picking up the camera. My work does that too, actually. It makes me think about, I take a lot less photos now at weddings than I used to, because it's about where are these images going to end up. And for me, it's bringing them into the tangible, printed.
Printed's so important. It's the thing that keeps coming up. Toying with the idea the other day of like, what if these conversations eventually became a book of themes? Not a book of like a transcript, but just what are the recurrent themes and maybe how, if you think of a series of conversations, like creativity, sometimes I think of it as like a river.
Yeah.
And as you're moving down that, that'll have different, there'll be different seasons and different places and things like that. But there are definitely at the moment themes, and I think it's because we live in such a virtual world that people are missing a tangible thing to hold on to,
The real, for sure, and that's what I'm offering through the weddings and the families. Is in the end, there is no point in them. I always say to them, in ending up in the ether. You know, I'm a millennial. I have gone through all the forms of music of how we store information. So, like my own wedding photos were on a CD, which got lost for a few years, and then we found them again, but thankfully I printed a wedding album, and that's the thing that you bring out every year, every anniversary, and look through. And it's also the quality as well of those images. Like my great-grandparents' images were printed really well, and they are like the day they were printed, whereas the ones you got done on the high street in Boots are fading, you know, from my teenage years when I went out and took photos. But yeah.
I love the idea of like the photos as well being ending up somewhere. I made a photo album once of found pictures. So he would go to like flea markets and stuff like that and just pick up pictures. And then he spent probably the best part of a year touching them up and editing them, putting them together, sequencing them in a way that made sense and was telling a story. And it's sort of a fascinating thing that like that can't happen with a digital picture. It can't just suddenly be found.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely. And it's about like, family images. There has been a little research on it, but children who see images of their themselves around their home, it's just really good for their well-being and their sense of security. I'm in the process of making our own hallway family gallery, which is crazy. I'm a photographer, you'd think I'd already have done it. But it, again, inspired by my own family home. My parents have a big jumble of photos. You know, it's like my mum's graduation in her first nurse outfit, cousins and their first baby photos, and I just love it. And that, it must have inspired me in what I've ended up doing.
Because it's not the same when they're just on a WhatsApp group.
Or, no.
You know, it's not, it doesn't have the same thing. It's funny, my grandma's just gone into a home, and she, it was funny, we saw her last weekend, and she has a handbag. One of her kind of touch points for her is, where's my handbag? Goes back to it. Look, she's got increasingly severe dementia, so it's one of the things that she really, it anchors her in space. And she was going through it looking for her keys and checking a few things, and in there is a stack of like Polaroids and little printed pictures and things, and I realised how many of the pictures I'd sent to her she's kept in the bag, and I don't know how often she looks at them, but when she does, and it's a shame because when she does, it's also often a surprise that they're in there, but they, you know, she remembers, she's like, there's the boys and there's Alice and there's me, and you know, and it sort of just helps her in that moment, and she's got these little things that she can hold on to and stuff like that. I really like the idea of having a family.
I think images are, they can do incredible things. Family photography, like if you pick up a, like looking through my own family album, like we all have our childhoods and we all have our, you know, no one goes through them unscathed. I had a wonderful childhood, but yeah, there's something about looking through the highlights, or possibly the lowlights. My dad was the photographer in our family, and it just, through looking at those images, I see my dad's love for us and his family, but also everything they did for us. As you get older, you might forget things. I'm the eldest child. I remember certain things, but actually looking back, it's good to see the other story, my childhood from my dad's point of view and everything he was doing for us. So yeah, I know people use photography as therapy as well. And I even have seen, I know in a recent podcast you were talking about self-portraits, like I did a self-portrait project, and you're also doing one at the moment, which is cool. But there's something, I think you touched upon it before, saying, you know, it's really good to kind of place yourself in the position as the being photographed, if you're going to photograph other people. And so something that I always find it a bit weird the way I say this, but I spend time many hours looking at people through, like on their wedding day, for instance, sometimes up to 12 hours, and I am watching the whole time. And then I come home and I edit those images, and I spend more hours looking at these people. And sometimes more is revealed about that person that I've maybe not seen in the moment, but more has revealed itself. And that what I get from that is just people are people, and they are, I love people. You know, like when you get to know anyone, you get to see them in all their foibles, everything. By taking photos of myself, I realized that I could also give myself that same approach, that same compassion. Growing up in the 90s, female, about, you know, the way we look. I think, again, you touched upon that. I think it's so important to just be like, I think often people say to me in focus, oh, get my best side. Often a certain generation say that to me, or, you know, get rid of my wrinkles, get rid of my grey hair. And I'm like, there is no point in changing your angles. You are who you are in that moment. And it's made me more comfortable in front of the camera, because it's just like, there's no point hiding. You know, this is who I am. And I hope that's how people feel when they see their images at the end.
It's an important practice that I think initially I felt very maybe a bit selfish, even in almost like I was indulging in something.
Yep.
Because initially you're like, right, well, all the early ideas I had were like the obvious ones of like, right, it's a little bit of shadow, and it's like, maybe there's a bit of, you know, it's just a bit of light on a face, or a bit, you know, like your ideas are kind of obvious and easy. And then it starts to get more interesting after a while, but you kind of have to, my other favorite topic of iteration cycles and practice and things like that. But I agree. I think it's a really powerful thing that I didn't expect to find as useful and powerful. Something everyone should try, like irrespective, I think, of whether they love photography, because we've got cameras in our pockets the whole time and we interact with cameras so much. Got taken to task about this recently by a former guest. Because I was like, does it make everyone a photographer? And he was like, no. And I ended up kind of agreeing with him. But people have access to the tools. And I think if you can see yourself, because we're bombarded with imagery constantly, and especially if you're younger and that imagery is telling you what they think is acceptable, it's like, well, if you can be a bit more comfortable with yourself and a bit more confident in yourself and not appalled by the picture someone posts online if you're in the background or whatever, I think that's it's difficult to navigate.
It's really interesting. I totally get that whole self-indulgent thing. So I did 52 self-portraits in a year, which happened to be 2020, which was really interesting that ended up being the year that I did it. And it around April, I just had enough of my own face. I was sick of it. I was sick of and I actually then took objects that represented myself and took pictures of them. Right. I did that for a couple of weeks. And I think that idea, I don't know who originally said it, but every image you take is a self-portrait. You can't help but get, you know, yourself in the picture. So even when I'm doing family portraits, I'm honing in on something that is part of my story and their story, and I'm homing in on that. The self-portrait, I used it, I don't know what your approach is, but it was play, which is central to all creativity, is just play and see what comes out of it. But it ended up being a form of therapy. I realised there was stuff that I was thinking about, but it wasn't on the tip of my tongue, it was deep down. And then when the image came out, it was like, that's what I'm trying to say. Not that I let the whole world know about it, but it was helpful for me.
Which I think is the other thing, is like a project can be a project and it can be yours. And it doesn't have to. There's also sometimes I think when you're, if you were to look at photography as a thing online sometimes, there's a tendency like, right, well, it doesn't mean anything unless you published it. And street photography is the only photography. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, well, actually, it's a tool to be used however you want to. Painters, multitudes of types of painting. No one looks at a Rothko and goes, that's not a painting, right? But it's not, you know, it's not a kind of photorealistic representation of a scene.
Yeah.
But it means something and it tells you something, and people interact with it in different, you know, it's what you bring to it. So, no, I really love that aspect of photography as well. I think it's one of these things these conversations are good for, is exploring all of it. Mm. Like talking, you know, the fact that you have to find someone to talk to every week means you find different photographers to talk to every week, means that you find different things, whether it's film soup or whether it's self-portrait with objects or whatever. But when you were talking at the beginning there about families and family portraiture and representation, was it your dad then, if he was the photographer around, was that what sparked your interest in picking up a camera?
Yes, probably. And it's only when you look back that you kind of start to pick it together of what your story is. I've mentioned family. I think I've been brought up by both my parents, who have very strong sense of family is important and your community. My parents travelled from when I was really young, went to the other side of the world, went and lived in Papua New Guinea, travelled all sorts. And so my dad, I've got my camera case here. I know this is a a sound platform, but he took photos. He's an only child, so he was taking his first grandchild away from his parents and sent photos back. But also he was documenting what he was learning. He was a doctor, and he must have been subconscious, but I saw him documenting our lives. We then returned and I had three younger siblings, and being a big sister is a big part of who I am. And I suppose they were my first muses, willingly or not. And I think that idea of people being my focus was there from the beginning. Yes, I took pictures, close-up pictures of flowers and stuff, but people in their environment was fascinating to me. And yeah, so it was my dad who gave me my first camera, which was one of his old ones. He got it, got some maintenance done on it, and then gave it to me, a film camera. I just loved it. I think I'd had some sort of digital camera before that. And I also did photography at school, not officially, but amazingly in my normal school, they had a dark room and they just said, do what you want.
Oh, wow.
So I used to dabble in film photography there.
Cool. Did you develop just black and white or colour or everything?
Yeah, but everything. And I'm trying to think back, like, how did we do it? But we just kind of learned and got on with it. And it was a great experience. And then I worked in for a charity as well. We did some developing film with the homeless, and that was really fascinating as well. Just seeing what other people focus on, what their interests are. Yeah, so I think that, like, I think you mentioned mentioning all these things in your previous podcast, but, you know, like, you're either the academic or you're the artist. And I know that simplifies things, but I think was lucky. Both my parents had vocational jobs and my dad was definitely an academic, but I really realised I wasn't early on and just owned that other side, that creative side, and was really encouraged.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure they had their hesitations, but then I went on to do design, which was very commercial and really made me realise how important meaning and creativity is. That was my beginning of my journey.
I have nothing but admiration for people who develop their own film, especially colour. I've only ever developed black and white, like very sparingly, and like done it a couple of times and was like, I'm good. Like, I think it's because I came up through digital. Mm-hmm. So I sort of just don't have this. I just didn't do it. And so consequently, because I didn't do it back then, it's, you know, it's hard to kind of give up. And there's so much change in editing and manipulation and thought and things. The digital workflow is probably more different to film than we give it credit for in terms of the way you're exposing the image, what you know you can do with it later. You know, I look at film photos and I'm like, look at those highlights. Like, look at the detail that's still in the highlights, like all that sort of stuff that you can't get away with. But on digital, exposed to the highlights and the shadows, you'll get away with absolute murder. Like, it's insane what you can do now. So they're very, in many ways, like, the form factor tricks us into thinking that they're identical, but they're definitely not. Like, they're it's a very different beast.
Definitely. It's something like, I mean, I think a lot of photographers get to this stage where they want to either if they're in one stage, they want to dab on the other side. And I would like to, as I was just saying to you, like, getting my actual film camera out again, prompted by this podcast, made me think, you know, I really do want to do that. But, like, yeah, the way I run everything or the way I do everything, there has to, it's the process of it is the chemicals, the environment. Obviously, digital has that side too. But yeah, I'm really interested in looking at how I can do that in a sustainable way and healthy way as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to be pouring awful chemicals away down the drain and things like that.
Yeah. It's always been, I think, well, I, as I mentioned, I did design at university and it was a very commercial course. And it's this idea of creating and making. And then I worked for a design company in London, won't mention who because the way they worked, but it's just mass production of so much stuff. And I did kind of go through a phase of, you know, why create more when there is so much? So that is something that does underlie a lot. And I sometimes, in a way, I feel like I'm getting away with it in the digital, but you're not. We're really not. And that's something I think more about, and it's the way I work as well. Less images, less stored, and only stored for a short amount of time because of the impact on the environment.
We have this feeling, don't we, that, like, sending an email is free and that there's no impact at all. And it's like everything's using some energy. It's why I worry about the generative AI stuff, aside from the fact that my personal feeling is that it's not very good, like, a lot of things, you know. And obviously it's improving, in inverted commas, but it's so energy intensive.
10 times more than Google.
And for what benefit?
Like, well, a lot of it's very frivolous. So, you know, recently there's this, everyone create your own doll of yourself.
Yeah.
And people are just doing it for fun, but many people ignorant to the fact that it is huge amounts of energy.
Yeah.
As a photographer, I'm sure you are the same, like, AI is a whole other, and I'm not sure where I am with it all. It's much like we're both parents. It's also that bringing up a generation who are growing up with all of this, and how we, the best thing I've heard about it is it's about the way we parent it. And I really like that. How we're bringing up this thing. Anyway, I don't know if I go into it fully.
It's a tricky thing to navigate, like with all change. And it's funny, there's a podcast I listen to called from the Verge website, the Vergecast. And they had the CEO of Adobe on a while back, and he was saying about how everyone says they don't want these tools, but then everyone uses the generative tools, and they're the ones that see the most usage in things like Photoshop. And I was like, that's a bit disingenuous though, because they're the default tool.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the software defaults to a certain thing, it's the power of the default. You know, yeah. Like on Windows, it used to be you used Internet Explorer because it was the default. It wasn't necessarily because it was better. So it's okay. It's okay for them to sit there and go, well, people use the tool. It's like, well, that's because in some cases
there has to be some responsibility.
Yeah.
Like we recently updated the software on the TV, and I noticed that it's got screensaver, and it says create an AI randomized image.
Mm.
And it's like, it's completely pointless. Well, yeah. This is my personal opinion. Why has that been placed there? But people, again, you need to be going into using AI, not ignorantly. You need to know what you're doing and, yeah, the use it has. And I just think, you don't know how many thousands, millions of people are just clicking on that and then a surge of energy. I mean, that's one side of it. And then there's obviously the more darker side as well.
But, yeah. I think I just worry about, like, the grey gooiness of it and like everything just becoming the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the as and look, there could be these court cases that are going on around the training material could potentially do real harm to the companies doing this stuff anyway, and it might, you know, people can turn, you know, attitudes can change. This might be a blip.
Yeah.
Or it might be the future of things. I don't know. But it's certainly, from my perspective, irrespective of like impact and whatever, it's like it's just not as good as a craftsperson making something. And so I do feel like it's just, you see it in games where they're using these tools to generate frames to kind of try out game ideas. But as someone working with creative people in a studio, I think it would be healthier if the designers worked closely with people who could program what they're programming, and then you would actually get a thing at the end of it rather than a video, because you're not going to then put that work product into anything. It's still at best like a wonky storyboard.
Yeah.
And like, well, you could describe that to someone with a pen and a whiteboard, and then they've forged a connection. Like again, like as you, maybe it's because I'm a parent as well, but when I'm working with especially younger people in the studio, sometimes I want to bring, not parent them, but like think about my interactions a bit more carefully than I maybe would have done before I was a parent.
Yeah.
To a couple, and you think about, right, what's the outcome I want? But also in the way of, what am I setting up here? You know, in the way that we approach like creative projects, we're like, what's the outcome? Where am I getting to? You'll have it with people at weddings and things like that, probably, or portrait sessions, where you're thinking ahead to the outcome and you're going to guide them towards that. I'm not sure that sitting in front of more tools that help a single person sat in front of that screen to reach an outcome.
Yeah, it lacks connection.
Yeah.
And ultimately, yeah, I mean, AI is going to get better. It's going to get better and better, and it will get, it's like, you know, at the moment, the photography it creates, it's quite obvious, but it's going to get very hard to tell. And I mean, I know some people, yeah, there's the guy who won a competition using AI as a point. But it's the thing that, like, I know people have used it when they've had a problem and they've reached out to ChatGPT instead of a friend. And that's the bit that I find more.
Yeah.
And also, it only uses whatever humans have only got to this point. It's like, so how do we evolve as a human race?
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. I worry about the same thing.
Yeah, so
yeah.
I do.
But from kind of ephemeral and not real to real, it's probably a good jumping off point for like one of your lenses. Do you want to pick one that we can kind of, this is an actual thing.
As I said, I'm sure you get this as well a lot. Like, I am not a gearhead. This is the lens I was given. So that you said to think about three lenses, and I suppose I've chosen three that kind of tell the story of my photography journey. So the first is, it's not one particular lens, but my dad had five lenses. One of them, I have no idea where it is, but, and one's a macro lens, which really he used it for medical reasons.
Mm.
But there's something about that really helps you focus. And that's really the story of photography, isn't it? It's noticing things. And that just honed me down into my own little world. And, you know, using a proper camera compared to, you'll know the word for it, but like, I don't know, it was just an Olympic or something. Yeah. Like standard camera I'd been using before, and this was really beautiful. And then my next lens was my first, well, not my next lens, but when I got my first own camera, I got myself a 50mm Nikon. It was, I think I got it secondhand, very cheap. And the reason I chose what that is because the idea that that is what you see. And it's now my son's camera.
Cool.
I've given it to him and I'm now seeing the images he's creating and I'm like, oh, which is also, I love that. Love seeing what people decide to take photos of. But that was my first prime lens and that's what set me down the whole prime lens. That's all I use now.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you have to really work up your composition and also it just for me it was beautiful. It was a sweet spot, of course. And now the lens I always have on my camera is a 35mm just another Nikon just because that's the one I had. And a few years ago I was part of like a group of women around the world. We were sort of working together on our photography and one of the questions that came up was, what's your distance? And the kind of like, a bit like, why are you choosing that lens over and over again? And I really looked through my work and I realized that for me that lens is about taking the environment in. So the people are important, but it's the people witnessing the space around them. And I think I've talked about it before, but I think it's really important to place ourselves in our environment. We're not separate from it. I obviously live in a beautiful area like yourself. You must love this. We live in a national park surrounded by forest. And I think it's especially important at the moment but that we see nature as separate from ourselves. But I believe that we are obviously nature ourselves. We are part of this creation, if you want to call it, or environment. So I think that's why that is my lens. It means I have to get quite close sometimes to my, but not super close. So it's that midway ground for me. And that's why I love that lens. In terms of like what type I use, I'm not a gearhead. It's had to be practical in budget. I had my first camera after my dad's manual camera was a Nikon and I have just stayed with Nikon because it's about the camera you have and I know. And as a wedding photographer, I don't have time to learn a new camera. I can't trust, it's the most important day of someone's life and I've never had the budget to have more than a few cameras at once. So I have just stayed on that journey. I mean, for me, Nikon has been lovely. I've loved the colours, but I now have these slightly newer lenses. I would say they seem more crisp and almost too crisp. But I had a Sigma before and I loved that. And it was always just a little bit, I don't know, there was something about it that I loved. But who knows if it's real or if it's just your experience. I don't know.
There's a strong part of you bring a little bit to it, I think, as well. Your brain is filling in a bunch of the gaps. There was some research done by Dolby, I think it was, years ago, into video and things like that, and the way that they could evoke using sound and colour to make you, like, they could show you fire and you would feel warmer and things like that. So I think there's definitely an element of we bring sometimes to it. Like, you get it with lenses. I had former guest and friend of the show, Dave Herring, finally bought one of my lenses because we've got the same camera, and my 35 Zeiss that I use for everything. Because like you, I love 35 because it's close but not too close and all the same reasons. It's a great lens. And the one I have is a little bit vintage feeling as well, which is kind of cool. And he finally bought one and tried it out and put this video out where he's like, oh, it's amazing. It's got this quality of the rendering and da-da. But I think part of that was also me talking about it in his ear most weeks going, do you know what? This is really special and it looks like this and it looks like that. Yeah. So when you then arrive and you're looking at it, sometimes you see what you're expecting to see, which isn't bad, because as long as you're creating things that you like, and as long as as long as the image, wherever it's going, whether it's just for you or whether you print it or whatever, like, I don't think it matters. I do think you're onto something as well with the slight sharp, like, we've over sharpened everything in our lives, and sometimes it's nice to use things that back that off a little bit.
Yeah, but definitely. I think it's what you were saying, yeah, it's ourselves, and like just reflecting there, the first lens was obviously when, you know, they talk about that. I was getting better and better very quickly, and then you plateau. And my husband's in, he's a mountain guide, so he's a coach, and he explained it really well to me. Like, I was saying how I just feel like my photography's not getting better. We talked about this plateau, and then and almost it's usually when you're about to make another leap, you know, you're really realizing where you're not good, and then and I suppose then I was seeing all that, and yes, I was being more creative because I was building my business, and now I am, yeah, most of the times I'm picking up my camera, to be honest, in the last couple of years is for work. And that's okay with me, because my being an artist, I'm very comfortable using that word. That doesn't have to be just through photography. It can be the way you live your life, it can be the way you parent, and that is where I'm at right now. So
I think that's really healthy though as well, because I think there's a danger. You mentioned it earlier, growing up in the 90s, and I've talked about this recently, but the idea that, like, when we were growing up especially, I think there was a definite, there's a track for this, like, you went down a maths and science route, or you went down a humanities route, and, you know, they were felt to be very exclusive to one another. And I don't think these things are as different as maybe they were compartmentalized for ease. But actually the most creative, interesting engineering projects, or, you know, like, science and innovation comes from noticing things, which might be a thing you've learned through photography, or, you know, I think you have to be open in your life in general, and then that's when the connections become obvious.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, like, the subjects I really struggled with at school were English, physics. I really loved physics, but I just didn't get it in school because they weren't teaching us really what physics was really about. I'm trying to think what the third one is because I just said three there. Anyway, I'll come back to it. But that is where I'm being creative now, is I'm having those conversations about physics, and I'm really would like to be able to articulate myself verbally now. Visually, that seems to be second nature to me, but I do think there's an importance of images with text and telling the story. Yes, people can interpret it how they want, but just giving a little bit more to that. And that's the way I'm being, not openly, but being creative, and maybe I'll be ready to share it later. But at the moment, yeah, that's the area I'm working on. And it's just sad that at school that wasn't something that was encouraged, because, you know, I wasn't ticking a box there.
It's funny, because if you were being creative in a programming sense and you were sometimes making visual programs that output visual things, you're doing that using maths, you're doing that using understanding, maybe you're simulating how light falls in a room, or, like, you know, so it's the output and the input don't always correlate with those arbitrary boxes that we've kind of created for things. And I think it also sometimes leads to people who are artists feeling a bit like a fraud, like they can't describe it, they can't quite tell you how they arrived at something, other than they did. You know, and that's okay too.
But and I totally agree with that. I'm probably quite inspired because I just recently went on a retreat, and it was very academic, and it was a whole other world. I felt like I'd stepped into another world where art exists, and you might just be creating those art, but there's this whole other world where people are interpreting it. And I found it fascinating. I haven't fully processed what I feel about all of that. Part of me was thinking about how, are you only talking to other people who talk about art, and really are, because I'm very much about for all, everything should be accessible. So yeah, that maybe touches on that. But yeah, the third subject was history. That's what
I was remembering.
And history is, well, I just think that feeds so much into photography and the stories that we tell and storytelling. And unfortunately, history for me at school was not sharing that. And now I realise, history is really interesting.
Yeah.
And we have a lot to learn from it. So, yeah.
True that. Yeah, I'm married to a historian.
So okay, well,
Alice,
there you go.
Alice studied history. She doesn't do it anymore, but, like, the importance of storytelling and seeing through lines. I like that Mark Twain quote about, like, history doesn't repeat, but it sure does rhyme.
And, and I think
we have a habit of not learning our lessons from history.
Yes. Yeah, we're seeing it happen now. Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
No, definitely. Well, the rich history of photography was once that maybe something else I wanted to touch on with you is, do you find, because you're creating a lot of art out in the world, do you find that you look at for inspiration to other, like, traditional photography sources, or do you draw your inspiration from kind of art and design sources more?
I draw inspiration from my life experience. So probably, maybe because I escaped learning history of art at university, I went down a different line. That isn't the line I've gone. Obviously, people inspire me. I grew up with Angel Adams, massive pictures in my parents' house, posters from when they were traveling in North America. My grandmother used to go and took me to see painter every time in Edinburgh when there was an exhibition, she would take me. So that has obviously infiltrated and culture. But now, no, but it is something that I think about. Maybe it's something I need to bring more into, but it's my life experience. And again, I think I said it before, but I don't believe, you said everyone's a photographer, maybe they're not. I do believe everyone is creative. And that can be accessed in any way. So yeah, I think I said my muses were my siblings, but they're now my children. Children are incredible noticers. So the forest to me now is a pirate ship tree. This is the lookout point. I now know trees by name because of the way they see the world. And that's, yeah. So, yeah, that's my inspiration.
Great. I look at a lot of photography books these days, and I try and go to museums and see stuff in print and things. But I think for me, that's a reaction to how much of my time is spent looking at effectively a screen and a thing that generates light. And I used to love going to art galleries when I was younger. I studied art at school. And, you know, so I find that I think that's my way of getting back in front of things and slowing it all down, and there's not a notification popping up, and there's not, you know, there's no distraction. Because screens are amazing. They give you access to incredible photos. Doing this, I get to talk to photographers. They send me examples of images to look at and stuff. It's really great. But it's not the same as having the space, both physically and mentally, that is created when you have to stand in front of something and look at it, whether it's books on the ground, or whether it's something on a wall or whatever. So I think for me, I'm adding to that collection. And I often ask people about their book collections or where their inspiration comes from, because I'm basically reassuring myself that it's okay to go out and just keep getting these books and filling these things. It's also really fun when the kids open them up and have a look as well. And they start looking at them and go, oh, what's that?
Yeah. I think because, as I said, I very early on sort of just wore that badge of, okay, well, I'm an artist, I'm creative. Yeah. I've maybe subconsciously got a process, and experimenting is, I can do that forever, and research, but I don't believe that it has to come, and actually sometimes better as a photographer. It depends what you're seeking, but uniqueness is important to me. Nothing is unique under the sun, but that's the pursuit of what I'm looking for. It doesn't have to come from another photograph. It can come from paintings, it can come from ceramics, it can come from a walk in the woods, it can come from your children. It's Helen Bonham Carter that says life is art, and I think I was pretentious enough to paint that on my jeans when I was a teenager, so
good.
Yeah.
She's correct though. I don't know if you know it, there's a guy, Rick Rubin, who, like, the famous, he's well known as, like, a music producer and things, maybe a guru as well in some ways. But he wrote a book about creativity called The Creative Act, I think. And it does open with
the opening to that book is something along the lines of, like, everything is creative, whether you're choosing what to have for dinner, whether you're solving a problem at work, whether you're helping a child with their homework, or, you know, it's like you are surrounded by creative problems that need to be solved all the time, and being human is being creative.
Yeah.
And the other thing he says in the book, which I really like, is some of the things in this book will resonate with you, some won't. Let go of the things that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, again, that idea of there's no right or wrong way to interact with anything.
Yeah.
Something will speak to you. You go around an art gallery, the walls are covered in things that people determined were important enough to be put on the wall. Doesn't mean you have to like them.
Yeah.
Or want to look at them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think I was wedded to that way too much when I was younger. As a kid at school who, like, followed the rules, did the right thing, you know, like, oh, that person is in a position of authority, therefore they must be anointed in some way. Mm. It's like, no, they're just a person who studied teaching.
Yeah.
They might not be any better equipped dealing with the world than you are.
Definitely, yeah. I think it just depends who your audience is as well. Like, there's two sides to what I'm doing. Obviously, I'm doing family and weddings and branding photography, and that is meeting a brief, and in terms of the designer, that is your job.
Mm.
But then as an artist, who am I doing it for? And yeah, like Picasso said, you know, once you've learned all the rules, you can break them.
Mm.
And if that's the audience you're working for who understand those rules, then maybe it is important. But I'm at the moment not exhibiting in the Tate. And for me, that is not my goal at the moment.
Mm.
So yeah, I have different goals. So my inspiration comes from, yeah, what's important to people?
Mm-hmm.
What is life about? Photographer of life. That's what I'm trying to do at the moment. So that is where my research is.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I'm lucky, you know, I'm a mother at the moment. So it's that mothering eye that is taking the photograph, even in the couples. You know, I'm been married, I'm in relationship, I'm going to be maybe a mother one day who's seeing my children make that step. It's so much more than just taking people's photograph. You are part of these people's life for a day or more.
Oh, more if we're lucky, right?
Yeah.
Like that's the really nice thing. It's like, you know, the friends who've asked me to photograph things for them in the past. I'm really lucky that, like, one of them was my sister-in-law.
Yeah.
So I was there before they had their first child. Now Archie's here, and I can, when he gets older, I'll be able to show him the pictures that we took of the wedding.
Yeah.
You know, when he was just an idea.
Yeah.
And but there's his, you know, there's his cousins, and there's me and Alice, and, you know, all that stuff. And then to go back and hopefully do stuff for the family again in the future.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think that's, like, I mean, that's something I'm hoping and is kind of happening, is being there for people at these life events. And once I already know them, that's the hardest step. And then you're invited in, because that's where, for me, the best photograph is, the camera you have on you, but also once people are themselves, fully themselves. Now, obviously, we are different people around different, people are chameleons, but a little bit of that. So when they get married, when they have a baby, then they decide to set up a business, you know, and I made a decision a few years ago based on what I see as successes, which is being here for my children. It's all very well taking these gorgeous photos of people and saying, oh, isn't love and family life? And then I was just away every weekend,
right,
you know, and not there for my own children. That didn't seem to sit right with me. So,
I've been thinking about that a lot recently as well.
Yeah,
just making sure that it sounds reductive and silly to say it, but when you're thinking, well, on the one hand, I can keep working 9 to 5 and all I get out of that is money. You know, I like the people I work with and things like that. And then the alternative is, well, you could do anything. You know, you could summer holidays suddenly become a completely different thing that we could do. We could travel as a family and go and work from somewhere and be somewhere else and do different things. Or, you know, just what does it enable? What does it open up that you can't do? And I also think a lot about the, like, when you were saying you're a mother at the moment, like, they're only going to need our intensive support for a finite amount of time. So we should probably enjoy that rather than see it as a burden that's stopping me going traveling, whatever. Because, you know, my youngest has been coming into bed with us in the night. And so we had a wake-up call at like 2 a.m. and it's a sleep regression at 7. I don't know why
he's
doing it.
We'll be doing it when he's 17, though.
Well, no, I flipping hope not. because it's making me quite grumpy. But it's a finite problem to have. And actually, if I can just lean into it, rather than going, well, I've got to get up and I've got to do this and I've got to get the wash on and all the life stuff.
This is all we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what are we rushing towards if it's not this?
Yeah.
It's not to be, like, for me, like, I've never entered photography awards or anything. It's just, that's not success for me. It's, yeah. And I think that feeds, but it's funny if you get that, it's not funny, it's if you get that bit right, then it actually does help your work.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to, you can't just do it for the money. You have to, there has to be meaning or there has to be love behind it. But I mean, I say all this, I think it's important to say, like, there's an element of privilege around that. Like, there was a point in our lives where it wasn't like that. And I've set boundaries in terms of I won't travel and stuff, but it took time to get to that point. You know, you have to, I had to work for that. Mm. And it's also about making choices, you know, living a much more frugal life because that's more important for us. So, yeah, I just want to state that if anybody's listening and is like, oh, well, it's very well, very well. Like, yeah, you know, I couldn't live in London for this.
No.
No. For what I'm earning.
No. But the nature of the work would probably end up being different as well. Yeah. You'd probably get sucked into a bunch of different recurring things. You know, like before you know it, you're...
And that's fine as well if people want to... Like, it's about choosing what... Well, when I say choosing, I feel like I've been very lucky. Everything has just kind of... or maybe it has been intentional. Who knows? We'll look back and see.
I think it can take years to create that overnight success, can't it? I think that's the thing. It's like it always makes sense in the rearview mirror.
Mm.
But when you're navigating it, it's the way forward is definitely not always very clear.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about listening to yourself. Like, I've done shoots and I've had a gut feeling about them.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, listen to yourself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, those gut feeling ones have put money in my bank that I've then reinvested in my business. So it's that, it is that balance. But I feel like sometimes I feel like more recently I've had that itchy feeling like, oh, I should be doing more. I should be building and growing, which I think is just what the world or our culture tells us. But actually, I have to remember, and I do this every time I drive to however small a shoot or whatever, I remember these people have put this money aside, this time aside. I am living my literal dream. I remember years ago having two very young children struggling to, we were counting the pounds and going, how will I create a creative job that I can fit around this family? And I'm now doing it and I have to remember that. And also never taking it for granted. And then it feeds into my, every shoot is unique and special. Yeah, basically a chance to hang out with people.
Yeah.
Be nosy.
Yeah, no, but it's lovely, isn't it? And I think that touches on that point I was making earlier, I think, about creative folks. Sometimes if you ask them to describe it in too much detail, you start to feel a bit like a fraud. You can't really explain why it works. It just kind of, it does. But it's a bunch of learned experiences. Yeah. This is the project manager in me coming out. It's like, it's sort of looking at something and going, well, actually, it's actually this and this and this and this. Because I sometimes think the thing you mentioned there about having bad experiences on a shoot, or not bad experiences, but like being actually in the middle of it and feeling a bit uncertain and would you do it again?
Being yourself.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's better to have those experiences. We've just had this at work where we gave the team bad news in terms of they were consistently missing targets, right, by a fair bit. And so we sat down last week with the team. We're like, look, we've got to face the fact that we are not doing this. And if we keep doing this, we will eat up all the contingency we have and then we'll be in real trouble. And so we've like sat down, we've delivered the message, which is uncomfortable. It's hard to deliver. People don't like to hear it because it makes them feel bad. But actually the experience of that is so much more, has had such a bigger impact on what's come out the other side a week later.
Mm.
And you're seeing people like redoubling their efforts and in terms of being more thoughtful about where they're applying their time and making sure that that's estimated properly and making sure it's being fed back properly. And when they're blocked, they're sticking their hand up rather than sort of just waiting for someone to figure it out. And it's just this proactivity that comes without wanting to sound like a psycho. Like sometimes you have to have the slightly uncomfortable bad experience to then know, because otherwise it's just academic and you're just going, well, it could feel like this one day. But until you've had that experience,
you have to fail.
Yeah, you don't, because you just don't know. And what we're seeing, you know, off the back of that, and I've seen it on other projects all the time, is like you have to go through that to then come out the other side and know, right, you know, episodes of the podcast where the recording went dreadfully or it's gone, like, I'm now much more comfortable asking people questions ahead of time, going, have you got this? Have you got that? Mm-hmm. Will it be quiet? You know, because it's nothing worse. I was looking at yesterday, a comment on Spotify from someone saying, the podcast's good, but could your guests have better microphones? I was like, well, I mean, I'll try.
Yeah, no, it's back to that experience, isn't it? For sure. Yeah.
No, that's great. Well, you were, last thing I was going to touch on with you, because you were dabbling a bit in video toward mm-hmm. the end of last year. Is that something you're adding to your bow, or was that something you just wanted to explore? And
it was going to be for personal use, things like capturing my dad talking, you know, my son dancing, things that I will always want to see. But it's turned commercial because I've been asked to do it. The thing that draws me to it is, I believe, well, music is the highest form of art, but I don't know who needs to put it in an order. Music, interestingly, is part of my process. Sometimes that's the way that I sort of edit or select the image or get what I'm trying to say out. I will just have like a couple of hours just listening to music and I'm in complete flow state with my work. When I'm doing self-portraits. But music and moving image work really well together. So yeah, fascinated by that. The downside is flipping storage. And again, coming back to that other stuff about, storage. And time editing, mm-hmm. And being uncovered. Yeah, you're going to have to ask for a lot more from people and have a lot bigger investment. So trying to work that out around the client that I am working with. So, you know, I'm not in the luxury end of the market. I'm in the mid-range and working on what would be best for my clients. So, yeah, something I'm exploring.
Yeah, oh, super fun. I'm resisting the urge to get into video. When I was down at the camera show, some people I know at Canon were like, hey, you could get some cameras and you could do the podcast that way. And it's like, editing this thing in audio is a gift.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact, I think it's also a bit more personal. You're in people's ears. You're not on a screen in the background. You know, like, you're actually, you're coming with them on a walk. I think there's more to do in audio. And I think it's too easy maybe to turn everything into a two-camera thing. Conan O'Brien talked about it recently on his podcast, where he spent 30 years on TV. And the nice thing for him about the podcast was he would sit down with someone in a room and just have a conversation. And then gradually they brought more people in, and then they brought in cameras. And he was just like, you may as well bring in the band. Like, we've practically made the show again.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like, now it's all on YouTube and whatever. But actually the thing he wanted was pair everything back, make it about a connection with someone, you know?
Definitely. And it helps the listener, because I think if there is a visual there, you're doing that as well. And it's just like another, you know, how we're always doing multiple things at once. It's actually quite nice to keep it singular, for sure. No, stick with it.
Yeah, no, I will do. Cool. Well, for people who are listening, where can they find a bit more Kat Parmenter on the internet?
Yeah, well, I'm katrinaparmenter.com, because it's photography at the moment, but who knows what it'll be next. Mm-hmm. I'm just on Instagram, Katrina Parmenter Photography.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A huge thank you to Kat for being on the show there. I really enjoyed that conversation. It was lovely. I think we should do more. I'm going to do more in-person stuff. Like, I want to do more on location. Let me know what you thought of that aspect. I've got a bit of a trip coming up in June. You'll hear more about that later. That's why I'm kind of practicing with these roads now, you know? If you're new and you liked that episode, don't forget that you can subscribe to the series wherever you get your podcasts. So that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Music, all the places. And hit us up with a review, give some comments. It's really great to hear from listeners. You can also subscribe to the weekly newsletter. That's available on ianfarrell.com/sign-up. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.